Don't touch my pandas. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump and China's Xi Jinping have stepped back from an all-out trade war for now.
It was a truce, but the war is still potentially capable of raging again.
Hey, maybe pandas would help reduce the tension. It's happened before.
After Nixon went to China in 72, the Chinese sent a couple pandas to the United States, Ling Ling and Sing Sing.
But as the saying goes, first they giveth, then they taketh away.
Obama was set to meet with the Dalai Lama, and the Chinese, of course, were really upset about this. Following the meeting, the Chinese recalled their panda.
Beijing's panda strategy and other cases of animal diplomacy, those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you along with us this Monday. Gas prices here in the U.S. have been dropping for the past few months. Great news, but don't get too comfortable.
It's entirely possible that we could see oil prices and therefore gasoline prices rising before the end of this year, and a lot does depend on the OPEC meeting that's coming up on December 6th.
Oil expert Ellen Wald. In a minute, she'll explain how politics affect prices at the pump. First, though, did you notice she mentioned OPEC, the oil cartel, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries? Most Americans, including myself, haven't paid much attention to OPEC lately. Back in the 1970s, though, we were paying attention.
Good evening. The Middle East war produced developments all over the world today. The oil-producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon.
You remember? I do. Riding my bike to school and not without a little smugness seeing all the cars lining up around the block waiting forever in line to buy gas. So will the long lines happen again? Ellen Wald says it depends what happens to OPEC.
OPEC would like you to think of it as a cartel, but it's not always a very effective cartel. And there are some times when it has been very effective. And one of those times was in 1973, when OPEC really controlled the vast majority or a very significant amount of oil production in the world and was able to manipulate that oil production in order to raise prices.
As far as membership in OPEC, I mean, we tend to think of Mideast oil nations as the members, but there are other countries part of it as well, right?
The reason that we think of OPEC as mainly made up of Middle Eastern players is because most of the founding members of OPEC were from the Middle East. OPEC was actually founded in September 1960, but it really didn't have any major effect until the 1970s. And the founding members of OPEC were Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. But then later, these countries were joined by a whole host of other countries as more oil was discovered in other places. So in 1961, we got Qatar, then Indonesia, Libya, the UAE, Algeria. Then in the 1970s, we got Nigeria, Ecuador, Gabon, and more recently, in 2007, Angola joined. And then in 2017, Equatorial Guinea and the Congo was the latest member to join in 2018.
What about like the U.S., Russia, and Canada? I mean, all oil producers and oil exporters, too.
Well, the United States is actually probably the largest oil producer in the world right now. The latest statistics showed something like 11.47 million barrels per day were produced in the month, I think, of September or October in the United States. And Canada is also a huge oil producer. Russia as well is also a very big oil producer, very much up there, probably produces around the amount that the United States does. But the United States cannot join OPEC.
And why not?
Well, first of all, that would be against the anti-competitive laws and anti-monopoly laws that we have in the United States. But also because the United States does not centrally regulate oil production. There really is no way for, say, the Energy Secretary of the United States to go into a group and say, okay, we're going to get all of the U.S. producers to cut production or increase production. That's just not the way the U.S. system works.
So with these two kind of oil balances of power, does OPEC still have the lion's share of the power?
Well, that's the big question. And OPEC still has a very significant role to play in the oil market simply because it does control a lot of production, and it controls some of the countries that have the biggest spare capacity. If Saudi Arabia wants to, at any point in time, it can increase production by more than any other country is able to increase production. The U.S. is producing at its maximum amount right now. Producers aren't necessarily holding back, but Saudi Arabia is holding back on that production, and Kuwait also has some spare capacity, same with the UAE. And so just by virtue of the fact that those countries can just make a decision and open the pumps to produce more gives them power in world markets.
So if the price of oil goes up, Ellen, wouldn't that be good for U.S. oil producers?
Yes, it would be good for U.S. oil producers. It wouldn't be the greatest for U.S. consumers who are loving, see, I don't know what oil prices are where you are, but gasoline prices, you know, in some parts of the country are below $2 already. So consumers are loving these low oil prices, but the producers in Texas would love to see oil prices go up.
So that brings us to Qatar and the news that it's leaving OPEC. I mean, what does that even mean? What's going to be the impact of that?
So it's a very interesting decision by Qatar to decide to leave OPEC. One of the important things to understand about Qatar is that it's actually not that big of an oil producer. In fact, its major energy product is liquefied natural gas. So Qatar only produces about 600,000 barrels per day, maybe as much as 620,000 barrels per day of oil, but it makes most of its money off of natural gas exports. And Qatar has also had a very difficult relationship with its Gulf neighbors of late, particularly Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And it's both a personal matter for the Qatari leadership and also a domestic political matter. It really probably sees no reason to be part of a group that has its positions dictated by Saudi Arabia when Saudi Arabia is making statements outwardly that it would like to basically end Qatar as Qatar exists today. There's an economic embargo on Qatar by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So it's certainly not an apolitical decision. Leaving OPEC doesn't really hurt Qatar that much because it doesn't produce all that much oil. But it is a jab kind of at Saudi Arabia because if more small oil producers like Qatar leave the group, that will decrease the overall influence of OPEC. Because right now, there are some really big producers. There's Saudi Arabia, there's Iraq, there's the UAE, there's Kuwait, there's also Nigeria is up there. There's also Iran, which could be a bigger producer than it is. But if the rest of them all get up together and leave, the smaller OPEC nations feel they're not being listened to, then that really could decrease OPEC's overall influence in the market.
Ellen Wald, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. Good to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The Middle East and the politics of oil featured prominently during the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. The 41st president of the United States, as you know, died Friday at the age of 94. As Washington prepares for his funeral, we wanted to take a look at one key part of Bush's legacy. As president, he oversaw the end of the Cold War and several key moments in the Mideast, including, of course, what is now known as the First Gulf War. I asked presidential historian Jeffrey Engel about that. We began with a ramp-up to the Gulf War back in 1990.
For one thing, we have to remember that this is still when the United States has, in many ways, a hangover from the Vietnam War. The last time the United States had sent this many troops overseas, it had ended quite poorly. And the military's reputation within the country was not nearly as much as it is today. So there was a real sense in which President Bush had to battle not only on the international diplomatic front, but also domestically. There was a genuine public discussion over whether or not this war should progress. There, in fact, was a Senate vote a few hours, really, before the fighting actually began in January of 1991. And the Senate only authorized President Bush to use force by just a scant few votes. It really was a very close-run thing. Though one critical thing to recall is that President Bush made plain in his diary and his private writings that he was intending to go forward with the war even if the Senate had voted against him. And his rationale was it was so important it was worth risking impeachment for. And, you know, it was significant for President Bush and for the nation and really for the world for a variety of reasons. It really was the first conflict after the Cold War ended. Not only was it in a vital strategic area, as the Middle East always is, and not only was it over a vital resource, oil, but critically, after the Cold War really was effectively over, the world and world leaders wondered what was going to be next and what would be allowed next. What would the superpowers let go, if you will? And therefore, President Bush and those around him, even though they weren't initially keen to come to Kuwait's defense, they realized very quickly, within about 72 hours, that for the post-Cold War world to be a peaceful one, they couldn't allow the first aggression to go unchecked. And really, that's the fundamental reason why President Bush wound up moving more than 500,000 American troops and collecting a coalition of dozens of allies to thwart this aggression and to set a precedent.
So many things with the relationships with Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and other powers in the region have evolved so much since Bush's presidency. Do you see things that happened on Bush's watch that maybe accelerated that evolution or changed it irrevocably?
Yeah, you know, I like to think of the Gulf War as really the last moment of the Cold War. And the reason I say that is because it's the moment when the Soviet Union and the United States, for the first time really in 50-odd years, stood side by side together against a common foe. But at the same time, it's also important to note that before 1990, before the Gulf War, the United States was, of course, interested tremendously in events in the strategic Middle East, but we really didn't have an on-site military presence. After 1990, after the Gulf War, after Saddam Hussein's invasion, that's really when the United States became, in effect, a Gulf nation. We have troops there. We have immediate interests there. We have bases there in a way that we didn't before. And those bases in particular were really what agitated Islamic fundamentalists such as Osama bin Laden to resent the American presence and to put pressure on the Saudi government. So really, in a sense, everything that we've seen since 1990, the modern Middle East is a direct result of the Gulf War.
So George H.W. Bush was kind of a classic American Cold Warrior, you know, U.S. battling the USSR. If you take that off the table, how do you think Bush 41 thought about and approached U.S. foreign policy, especially after 1990?
You know, he actually was really a traditionalist. He believed in the world that Franklin Roosevelt created after World War II that we never actually got to implement because of the Cold War. It was a world that relied upon multilateral strength that was exhibited through the United Nations. It was a world that relied on free trade. Of course, President Bush was the one who really did most of the negotiations for NAFTA. It was a world that really relied upon American power. One of the critical elements, in fact, I think perhaps the single most important element of Bush's foreign policy was that he was determined, no matter how the Cold War ended, that the United States would remain engaged in Europe and around the world, because his lesson of the 20th century, his entire reading of the 20th century, was that when the United States retreated from its global responsibilities, wars followed. And he believed that the United States needed to be an on-site military presence around the world in order to make sure that, well, frankly, that crimes didn't happen under the policeman's watch.
I mean, Donald Trump isn't exactly isolationist, but I mean, he is America first. Would you say that Trump is kind of the diametric opposite of George H.W. Bush when it comes to foreign policy?
Yes. In fact, I'd actually go even further than that. I'd say that Donald Trump is consciously trying to destroy and deconstruct the entire post-World War II order that George Bush not only embodied, but fought for as a young man and then subsequently fought for as a president. His entire purpose in life was to have the United States lead in the world and also lead with multilateral institutions at its back. Multilateralism is not something President Trump talks about. Leading is not something President Trump talks about. Human rights, something else that was important to President Bush, was not something that Donald Trump talks about. I really can't think of a president who is more unlike George H.W. Bush than the current one.
Author Jeffrey Engel, the director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Texas. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Before the break, a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow. Recently, officials broke ground for a new crossing between Pakistan and India to allow Indian Sikhs visa-free access to a holy site in Pakistan.
It's very important for me as a person to be able to go there and see the shrine.
That's Baljeet Singh, president of the Sikh temple in Westboro, Massachusetts. He says that as a Sikh, he's happy he'll now be able to visit an important holy site. But he also thinks the new crossing can have a much wider positive effect.
When people will go and visit these places and open up to each other, I believe that's a good start for a better future.
My conversation with Baljeet Singh tomorrow on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The markets liked what they heard from President Trump and China's Xi Jinping over the weekend. The two leaders met on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Argentina and seemed to pull back from an all-out trade war.
It was a truce. But the war is still potentially capable of raging again.
David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. So let's start with the basics, David. What did the U.S. get? What did China get?
Well, one of the problems we have reading this meeting is that the U.S. and the Chinese have put out their own basically competing versions of what happened. You have Donald Trump doing a full kind of PR job about how fantastic the deal was, talking about who's going to benefit. U.S. cars are going to have lower tariffs. U.S. farmers are going to be selling huge amounts of stuff to China. And that he's given the Chinese 90 days to meet a lot of his demands. Otherwise, his people are saying the tariffs will go back on. If you look at the Chinese state media description of the meeting, there is no mention of the 90 days deadline when tariffs would come back on. There is no mention of the Chinese buying a ton of stuff. And it's all much more about, you know, we're delighted to say that the two men met and they agreed that they need to cooperate and not be at odds, and now we can sort of talk. So if you are an optimist, you can say this is a lot better than an escalation. There could have been an escalation. We could have had immediate tariffs. But if you're a pessimist, and particularly if you're a pessimist about Donald Trump's willingness to do a deal that sounds good rather than a deal that is a really good deal, then maybe you're getting suspicious right now that we're in another sort of Donald Trump deal that isn't quite as good as it seems.
I mean, it's believed that this agreement to back off from the edge of the cliff will allow both sides to take a deep breath and avoid, I guess, some serious trade war. What remains unresolved? And in the time that they've allotted themselves, is there enough time to resolve stuff?
It depends if you take, for example, remember the speech that Vice President Mike Pence gave a couple of months ago now, which was a very, very aggressive kind of charge sheet of complaints against China, economic complaints, complaints to do with spying, to do with interfering in America's elections, you know, very, very long kind of rap sheet of things that America wants China to stop doing or to change. There's no way that that can get fixed in 90 days. There's probably no way that China is willing to change its way of business. My cats just ran through the sitting room chasing each other. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
There is no way that China can make those kind of gigantic changes within 90 days. In fact, there's probably no way that China can really make many of those changes anytime soon at all. One fascinating thing sitting here in Beijing is I spend a lot of time talking to reformers and liberals, economists, people who've been very involved in the whole period of the last 40 years of getting China involved in reform and opening to the world. That group of liberals are a kind of rare breed of liberals for Donald Trump. Chinese liberals who believe in economic reform have been quietly rooting for Donald Trump, not because they particularly like him, but because they think that only pressure from the world's largest economy, America, can actually force the current Chinese government to come back to the path of reform and opening, which means lowering barriers to foreign investment, stopping intervening in the economy so much, getting the Communist Party to back away and let the market take over. Those kind of reformers, they've actually been hoping that pressure from Donald Trump would drive some much-needed reforms which would be good for China.
David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Let's check in now on the situation in Tijuana, Mexico. That's where thousands of migrants have been waiting for a chance to seek asylum here in the U.S. The World's Monica Campbell was just there. What were we just hearing, Monica?
We were just hearing numbers and names being called out, part of this sort of makeshift waiting list that people who are seeking asylum in Mexico are putting themselves on. And so every day in the morning, you have people line up and they hope to hear their number. And then that may allow them to approach the U.S. border and make their case for entering the United States. So it's kind of a chaotic scene, but it's one that we're seeing every morning in Tijuana.
So what's the latest from Tijuana? You were there this weekend. What did you see?
Well, this weekend, we saw thousands of migrants moved from this municipal sports stadium to a shelter about 30 minutes away from the border. It's a much better place for people. This open-air stadium with rains turned into like a mud pit. It was a disaster. It wasn't livable. So a lot of people moved to this other shelter. At the same time, it's far from the border psychologically and physically. And so a lot of migrants opted to leave that sports stadium, but then like stay around the border area. So you have a lot of people still sleeping on the streets and packing the cheap hotels right near the border and in churches. So this large group of migrants has sort of split into different parts of the city.
Yeah. So for those people who have been moved to that other shelter, a 30-minute drive from the border, what does that tell us about plans for their future?
Well, it's in a way, I mean, if we talk about what the Trump administration and Mexico's government are seem to be sort of circling around, this plan to have migrants stay in Mexico while they try and seek asylum in the U.S., when you go to that shelter that's 30 minutes from the border, it sort of feels like that plan is already in place. Like that is the remain in Mexico plan that Trump has been talking about. And migrants in Tijuana are feeling increasingly desperate. They see that it's going to take at least a month for them to approach the U.S. border, at least. And in the meantime, some are feeling, well, you know, maybe we should stay in Mexico. People feel that they need to start making money somehow to start sending it to their families back home.
Now, I hear Mexico is actually offering people jobs. Are migrants taking them?
Absolutely. I was at the new shelter and people were boarding buses to this job fair. And I met one woman. Her name is Christina. She was 29 years old and she ran a fruit stand in El Salvador and was getting extorted, she says, by gangs there. So she left her home. Now she's in Tijuana. And this is what she told me.
¿Dónde van ustedes?
Tenemos una cita ahora para poder irnos a registrar y poder tener un trabajo. Quedarnos acá en Tijuana.
She's in line to board a bus that will take her to a place where she will get a work permit and a possible job. And this piece of paper says that 7-Eleven may have an opening for her. She would like to work there and remain in Tijuana. For how long? ¿Por cuánto tiempo?
Pienso quedarme el tiempo necesario.
So she says there that she'll stay in Mexico for as long as necessary. She wants to start earning money immediately. She is desperate to send money back home to her elderly mom who couldn't join the caravan. She's without options. She has to make money. So she'll take that job in Mexico.
Yeah, for the migrants, it really does not sound like the kind of reality they were hoping for. The World's Monica Campbell, who was just in Tijuana this weekend. Thanks very much for telling us what you saw, Monica.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, what is it like seeing the Greenland ice sheet for the first time?
It's insane. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. It looks like it can't even be real. It's like Manhattan. It's like the skyline of Manhattan, but ice.
But there is danger beneath the beauty. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
We need more action and more ambition. If we fail, the Arctic and the Antarctic will continue to melt.
This was today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at the Global Climate Conference in Poland.
The oceans will rise. More people will die from air pollution. Water scarcity will plague a significant proportion of humanity. And the cost of disasters will skyrocket.
That joins the almost daily warnings from scientists about what lies ahead as the world heats up. Guterres singled out melting in the Arctic. It is warming fast up there, and that's a big deal for all of us. On The World, we've been paying close attention to what's happening in the Arctic for a couple of months now, together with the Threshold podcast. Today, we have our final story from Threshold's Amy Martin. It's about the Greenland ice sheet.
I'm in a place called Ilulissat, a small town on Greenland's west coast. The ocean is sparkling in the sun next to a steep rocky hill, and I'm out doing some exploring. I step onto a boardwalk that snakes off through a marshy field, then down toward the shore, where I come upon this cheerful notice.
Extreme danger. Do not walk on the beach. Death or serious injury might occur. Risk of sudden tsunami waves caused by calving icebergs. Duly noted. Not going to the beach.
So instead, I head up, onto the side of the hill, and for a few minutes, all I can see is rock.
Okay, I'm coming up.
Until I come around a curve.
Oh. What? Oh my gosh.
I just came up over this little rise. And there's like a mountain of ice right in front of me. Oh.
What I'm seeing is a range of huge white peaks, and it takes a while for my brain to register what it is. These aren't actually mountains. They're peaks of solid ice, some of them 3,000 feet high.
It's insane. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. It looks like it can't even be real.
With every step, I can see further and more. Miles and miles of ice.
It's jagged in some places, smooth in other places. It almost looks a little bit like it's made out of sugar, like meringue or something, but filling the landscape. They're so big. The ice chunks are so big that they make like their own shadows and shapes. It's like Manhattan. It's like the skyline of Manhattan, but ice.
The ice sheet before me seems to stretch out forever. It slowly rises from the edge of the ocean to more than 10,000 feet tall in the center. It's as big as Alaska. And some of the ice is more than 100,000 years old. Everything about it is fascinating to me. I want to touch it and walk on it, but it's super dangerous in this spot. The ice is shifting and cracking, so I have to wait until a few days later.
Should I go ahead and hop out?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm stepping out of a helicopter onto the Greenland ice sheet, my home for the next 5 days. I'm here with three students and three professors who came to study how this place works. We are the only splotch of color out here. It's ice as far as we can see in all directions. As soon as we climb out, we're pounded by the wind, and it feels like I'm walking on frozen beer foam. The ice here is pockmarked with shallow holes. Some are tiny, some are large enough to lose your foot in, and they're all filled with freezing cold water.
It's a pretty interesting surface with this honeycomb. I mean, half of what we're walking around on is not ice. It's whole, filled with water.
This is Joel Harper, a glaciologist from the University of Montana. Up here, you really get how all of this is a massive storehouse of fresh water.
Yeah, there's a lot of it here. If you took all this ice and converted it to water and added it to the ocean, sea level would come up 7 meters.
Whoa.
So that's how much ice is here. Quite a lot.
Wow. 7 meters is 23 feet. Think about that for a minute. Adding 23 feet of water to the ocean would displace millions of people all around the world, from Mumbai to New York. And it might well happen. In fact, it's already starting to happen. The good news, Joel says, is that we're not going to lose the whole ice sheet all at once. But he and this team are trying to figure out how this mountain of ice is moving into the sea and how fast. It's an area of study called ice sheet dynamics. And the first step in understanding it is grasping that this ice is dynamic. It moves.
Yeah, it's flowing like a fluid. Ice is essentially, you know, a giant fluid.
And just like with any other fluid, gravity pulls the ice from high to low. So in this case, from the middle out to the edges.
Ice sheet motion is taking mass from the high parts of the ice sheet and moves the mass towards low elevation, where it either melts in warmer temperatures or calves off into the ocean.
Melting and calving at the edge of an ice sheet is normal. But, and this is a big but, normally the ice being lost at the edges is replaced at roughly the same rate by new snow falling in the middle.
Problem is, we're having more mass loss than we are gain at the moment, so that's why sea level's going up.
So as we warm the planet, we're knocking the Greenland ice sheet's balance out of whack. It's losing more ice than it's gaining. And the huge challenge for scientists is to figure out what might happen here under these new conditions. Is the ice likely to melt at a steady pace or in pulses? What role does the melt on the surface play? And what happens if the ice sheet begins to break apart?
This is where the motion part that we're working on really comes to play.
And where this team is focusing its work. What were you thinking when the helicopter flew away?
I guess I'm in it now, can't back out. Sort of trapped.
That's Rosie Leone. It's her first trip to Greenland. She's one of the three students here. Aiden Stansberry is another.
Can you tell me what you're going to do?
Basically, we are going to go out and drag this radar around to map the bed. Really not an expert.
Rosie and Aiden basically have one job on the ice: use radar to map the bed underneath us.
So the bed is the rock that the ice is sitting on top of. So we're going to be walking around trying to map out this, so we can see what the bed looks like, which can give some insights into how the glacier's moving, I guess.
The ice sheet bed can be made of different kinds of rock or soil or sediment. It can be flat in one part and hilly in another. And part of what the team is trying to figure out is what happens when you combine all of that variability with the enormous weight of the ice sheet. How does the shape of the bed change how this thing moves? To make the map of the bed, the students are walking in straight lines a certain number of meters. Then they stop, send down a radar pulse, log the data, and do it again and again and again, in the wind and the cold, all day long.
I guess right now radar is just a little boring.
Rosie's being nice. It's not a little boring. It's super boring. But it's important. And today, Team Radar gets a break, because Joel's taking us out to meet a moulin. Joel had warned us about these things called moulins, holes you can fall into on the ice sheet, never to be seen again. They're pretty spooky, but they're also intriguing portals into the belly of this massive beast. Because this ice isn't a solid block from top to bottom. It has an internal plumbing system. There are rivers and lakes on the surface, but also inside of it and underneath it. And Joel says we don't really know all that much yet about how the water moves in there and how that might affect the overall movement of the ice sheet. But as we walk out to find a moulin, I have a much more basic question.
All of this ice that we're looking at, this was all once snow, or did some of the ice actually form from water a long, 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 long time ago? Or?
No, this all originally fell as dry snow 20,000 years ago.
We're following one of the many winding streams that form on the ice sheet in the summer. And then, there it is.
Wow.
A big hole in the ice.
So it's safe here, but you don't want to step out there.
Yeah, don't worry.
But you can see the stream is just plunging into the glacier. And not only do you not want to fall in that hole, you don't want to fall in this stream anywhere, because the bottom of that stream is just ice. It's completely slippery.
Oh, God.
And the current just carries you along and along and along until you end up in the hole.
Oy.
But there's a spot a little ways off where it's safe enough for me to lay down on my belly next to a crevasse and put my microphone right down into it. It's an eerie rumble, and as I look down into this crack in the ice, it goes from white to blue to a mysterious glistening black. It feels like there could be some mythical creature living down there, or that this whole Leviathan itself could be alive. That's one of the things that makes the Greenland ice sheet so mind-blowing. It's made of this very familiar substance. It's just ice. But it's at a scale that's so different, it almost feels alien. It's not very often that we have the chance to encounter a discrete object that's this huge, let alone hold a microphone up to its mouth and listen to its voice. And Joel says what happens down there is just as important as what happens up here.
20 years ago, there was some debate as to whether or not water could find its way to the bed of the ice sheet, this surface melt we see, whether it could even get through a kilometer of really cold ice. Since then, we've learned that it absolutely does. But now we're stuck with two new problems. One is how. We don't have that figured out entirely. And the second is, well, what are the impacts of that? What does it do to the sliding motion of the ice sheet once it gets down there?
The answers to these questions could have effects all over the world. And Joel says the potential sea level rise from that melting is only one of the reasons why this ice sheet is so important.
Ice itself is a big part of the climate system. Ice actually influences how the climate system works.
One of the ways it does that is through albedo, the way the white ice reflects solar energy away from the Earth back out into space. It helps keep the Earth comfortably cool for humans. But when the ice here melts into pools or channels on the surface, it turns a vibrant blue. It goes from a light surface that reflects heat to a dark surface that absorbs it. And that just adds to the warming we're already causing. It's the same thing that's happening as sea ice melts on the Arctic Ocean. That's why there's some urgency here to get a better understanding of the processes that are transforming this big hunk of planet-cooling ice into water.
What really matters here is how fast. You know, if it takes 3 or 4 millennia to get a large amount of melt from Greenland into the ocean, that's a completely different societal issue if it's only a century or 2 or 3.
Seeing and hearing all this water moving around up here really brings home that I'm standing on a pivot point of our future. The Greenland ice sheet is spectacularly beautiful and kind of unreal. It almost feels like another world. But even though most of us don't think about it much, it's actually a key part of this planet. And if our pollution continues to warm up the climate, that's going to become increasingly clear. 600 million people live in coastal areas less than 10 meters above sea level. That's 32 feet. As this ice sheet melts away, an awful lot of those people are going to have to find somewhere else to live. That's a recipe for intense societal disruption. That's what lies in the uncertainty around Greenland's future. And that's how the science Joel Harper and his team are doing here intersects with questions that have huge implications for all of us, all around the globe.
Even if you live at a southern latitude somewhere, if there's big change in the poles, it will impact how the climate system works, and it will ultimately work its way down to impacting you.
For The World, I'm Amy Martin, Greenland.
Amy's reporting on climate change in the Arctic comes to us through our partnership with the Threshold podcast and funding support from the Pulitzer Center. You can check out stories from Iceland, Sweden, Russia, and Alaska at theworld.org/thebigmelt. An incredibly beautiful place, its existence melting away, yin versus yang, which brings us to another Mood Music Monday, where we ask you to tell us what your mood has been and what song goes with that mood, or a song that helps you adjust your mood. Today, the request comes from David Klopfenstein, who listens to us on Oregon Public Broadcasting and KOPB. David must know my musical tastes well because he requested Shuffering and Smiling by the late Fela Kuti from Nigeria.
You Africans, please listen to me as Africans. And you non-Africans, listen to me with open mind.
David wrote to say that Fela Kuti wrote music that educated and inspired in the moment and continues to impact the world every day. I used to play this record at work to make that point to everyone within earshot, he says. The lesson that David takes away from Fela's Shuffering and Smiling, count your many blessings, and once that smile returns, admit how much of those blessings are rooted in arbitrary, unearned privilege. So, David, many thanks for the request today.
Every day my people, they inside bus.
Suffering and smiling.
Every day my people, they inside bus.
Suffering and smiling.
49 sitting, 99 standing.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go pack themselves in like sanding.
Suffering and smiling.
Them they faint, them they wake like cock.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go reachy house water no day.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go reachy bed power no day.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go reachy road go slow go come.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go reachy road police go slap.
Suffering and smiling.
Them go reachy road army go whip.
Suffering and smiling.
Shuffering and Smiling by Fela Kuti, a request for Mood Music Monday from David Klopfenstein, who listens to us in Oregon on KOPB. You all know what to do. Tell us your mood and the song that goes with it. I'm at Marco Werman on Twitter and Instagram. Also on both platforms, we are at PRI The World. The request stream is now open.
Suffer, suffer for one.
Amen.
Enjoy for heaven.
Amen.
Christians go they yap.
Amen.
It's spiritual heaviness.
Amen.
Muslims go they call.
Allahu
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Maybe you saw the picture this weekend of Sully, George H.W. Bush's service dog, resting in front of his master's casket, as if still keeping watch over the late former president. Many of us humans have an emotional connection with dogs, not just our dogs, any dogs. That's one reason why dogs and other animals sometimes end up involved in diplomacy. Most recent example, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gave 2 Pongsan hunting dogs to his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in as a symbol of friendship and reconciliation. It really was the gift that kept on giving because one of those dogs later had puppies. I heard all about it from Elias Grohl at Foreign Policy. So let me just work the cuteness angle before we move on. The Pungsung hunting dog, are they cute little puppies? Like on the cute meter, what's the score?
Oh, definitely. 10 of 10 would cuddle again. there's six of them. They're small. They're adorable. You can see the South Korean president and his wife snuggling these dogs on a blanket. The South Korean president is wearing a down vest and hiking shoes, and his new dog is looking over the litter, and the South Korean president's wife looks on adoringly. It's a very happy photo of the new family.
As you note, for Foreign Policy, dogs and other mammals, furry, cute mammals, have been part of international diplomacy for a while. What is the earliest instance you know of?
We can go very far back in history. For example, in the late 1820s, the Egyptian ruler Muhammad Ali Pasha sent three giraffes to various European courts as a kind of diplomatic maneuver. But the modern era of animal diplomacy, if you will, probably began with the Chinese. After Nixon went to China in 72, the Chinese sent a couple pandas to the United States, Ling Ling and Sing Sing. Those two pandas became star attractions at the Smithsonian National Zoo. And that was one of the starting points of this phenomenon of Chinese panda diplomacy, if you will. So China is the only country that is home to pandas, right? And so China uses these animals as diplomatic tools. They dispatch them to countries around the world, to zoos.
And also, I mean, isn't the Smithsonian Zoo in Washington, aren't they paying now China for the pandas?
Yeah, they are paying them now. Yeah. So they're not gifts anymore. They have to pay a few million dollars for the privilege of playing host to these pandas. A few years ago, there was the interesting story of a panda in the U.S. named Tai Shan. At the time, this was during the Obama administration, and Obama was set to meet with the Dalai Lama, and the Chinese, of course, were really upset about this. But the meeting went ahead anyway, and then following the meeting, the Chinese recalled their panda, if you will, and Tai Shan had to return to her home country. Whether it was actually a response to the meeting with the Dalai Lama or not, it's not entirely clear, but observers of panda diplomacy will certainly argue that this was an example of Beijing using control over its panda assets to use them as a diplomatic tool.
I've heard this story. Is it true? Richard Nixon responded to Mao's gift of Ling Ling and Sing Sing by sending two musk ox to China.
I think the U.S. got the better end of that deal. But yeah, it was two musk oxen, I think they're called.
I'm wondering, are there any modern examples of like a real Trojan horse, animals that are intended to be problematic for their new owners?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, there have certainly been animals that have been given to heads of state that are maybe a little surprising, right? So in 1990, George H.W. Bush went to Indonesia to meet with then President Suharto, and George H.W. Bush was given a couple of Komodo dragons, which are, you know, these giant lizards, like more than 7 feet long. They have not poisonous saliva in their mouth, but highly bacterial saliva in their mouth. So they'll bite you, and then the wound typically becomes infected afterwards. They run really fast. They're really scary creatures.
They are scary. I've seen them before.
So those animals made their way to the Cincinnati Zoo. One of them, Naga, is said to have fathered 32 Komodo dragons.
Wow, he did say 32. That is one prolific lizard, and definitely not fuzzy. Elias Grohl wrote about the tradition of animal diplomacy for Foreign Policy. And finally today, a story that caught my attention this weekend, maybe yours too. Nick Jonas and Priyanka Chopra have now officially tied the knot. Talk about warm and fuzzy. So what happens when a heartthrob American singer weds a Bollywood superstar? Two wedding ceremonies for starters, one Christian and one Hindu, and several other super exclusive events. Chavi Sachdev is in Mumbai, so the wedding happened in Rajasthan, which is north of you. Just give us a few of the spectacular details that you spotted while you were watching the reports from Mumbai, unless you got a last-minute invite, Chavi.
No, sadly, I was not on the guest list. I actually have friends who work in the wedding industry, and I've heard that everybody who is not a guest has been asked to tape over the lens of their phone camera.
Really?
And it's true. There are like only 10 or 11 photos out there. If they're out there, they're coming directly from their Priyanka's and Nick. I'm talking, of course, like I'm friends with them. But yeah, Priyanka Chopra, Nick Jonas's accounts and their designer. So it was happening at the royal residence in Jodhpur, one of the largest private homes in the world, also a hotel, more than 350 rooms. And it sounds like there was a lot going on for the Indians as well as the Americans. There was even a cricket match for the families and a pajama party.
And have Indian media come up with any good married couple names for Nick Jonas and Priyanka Chopra?
So I've been seeing Niyanka, but the worst one is Nikyanka. It's just so unsexy.
Yeah, it sounds also, a little weird, Nikyanka.
Yeah, Priyanka Ki Shadi, which just translates to Priyanka's wedding, is the more popular, more trending hashtag here.
Well, it seems the only scandal are the fireworks that went off during the wedding. What happened there? Yeah.
So last month, India celebrated Diwali, the festival of lights, which is also the festival of noise. We set off fireworks and it's usually quite loud and quite smoky. And because we have an air pollution problem, the Supreme Court cracked down on fireworks going off. So everybody is really up in arms that Priyanka Chopra, who was on TV last month asking people to please refrain from bursting firecrackers because she has asthma, it's really unhealthy, it scares the animals. And here we are at this wedding where the fireworks are incredibly large, grand, and noisy, and definitely not safe by any standard. So people are really outraged.
This is the big wedding season in India and in Pakistan. Do couples try and outdo each other at these weddings? I mean, and is there any way anybody could outdo Priyanka Chopra and Nick Jonas's wedding?
Of course, you have to keep up with the Joneses, but I don't think they could outdo this one. The wedding season will go through December, a little bit into January, and wedding planners and all the peripheral sort of hospitality and service industries, this is the time they do make their money. There are weddings every day, sometimes more than one at the same venue in the same time frame.
Well, the weddings will keep up with the Joneses. We're keeping up with the Jonases and the Chopras. Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to leave it there today. I'm Marco Werman from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.